This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. This is our 600th interview in the Conversations with History series. Our distinguished guest today is the Right Honorable Lord Patten of Barnes. Lord Patten is the Chancellor of Oxford University. His distinguished career includes serving the United Kingdom as Secretary of State for the Environment, Member of Parliament from Bath, Chairman of the Conservative Party, Governor General of Hong Kong, Chairman of the Independent Commission on Policing for Northern Ireland, Commissioner for External Affairs of the European Union, and Chairman of the BBC Trust. His most recent books are Not Quite the Diplomat and What Next? Surviving the 21st Century. This is, I'm pleased to say, the fourth time Lord Patten has been a guest on the program. At the end of the last interview, Lord Patten asked, after I had thanked him for his appearance, have I survived to do the fourth? And my definitive answer is yes. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much indeed.
A theme running through several of the interviews we have done with you is the importance of ideas. And in your most recent book, you say, I am a liberal internationalist. Remind us what that is for our American audience and the ideas that go with that principled position.
I think a liberal internationalist believes in many of the impulses, much of the momentum which has created the last surge in globalization. I think a liberal internationalist believes in free trade and its benefits to both the exporter and the importer. I think a liberal internationalist believes that different cultures and nationalities, even if they have their own traditions, don't operate and live in silos. There's an extraordinary interweaving between them. I think a liberal internationalist probably believes, certainly this one does, that the West doesn't have a monopoly of virtue when it comes to issues like civil liberties and human rights. I think a liberal internationalist believes that those are issues which are important to human beings wherever they are. I think a liberal internationalist reckons as well that for one nation to get better off isn't a threat to others. It's for all our good. I think it's fair to say that those are propositions, many of which are challenged today, both by populist movements in Europe and the United States, and by a growing and, I think, rather dangerous view that authoritarian regimes are somehow better at delivering the goods than liberal pluralist democracies. And that's both an issue of practical challenge to democratic politicians, and it speaks as well, I think, to our lack of self-confidence in the values which have actually made our societies thus far.
Another theme that we pursued in the interviews, and I think what you think is important, is the problem of leadership and what exactly political leadership entails. Because as the world changes, that's becomes a more difficult task for political leaders.
I've begun to feel increasingly as I've got older that life is a predicament, that it's very difficult to think of it as being, as one political philosopher argued, a sort of wagon train which takes you to a known destination, and you know the route, every roll of the way, you know where the stars align, you know exactly where to go. And I don't think life is actually like that. I think life is about trying to manage to cope with really difficult, sometimes intractable problems in as amiable a way as possible. And I believe that leadership is understanding that, knowing how you want to plot your way through the next problems, deal with the next opportunities and challenges, and to have the skill to explain what you're doing to people and to carry them with you. I think one of the consequences of all sorts of developments in the last few years, not least the speed at which news is travels around the world and is absorbed, one of the problems is that too many leaders have been reactive rather than trying to assert their own agenda and what they how they want to cope with imagined problems, real problems. And I think that's led to too much followership as opposed to leadership, and too much kowtowing to populism. It's easy to tell people that you can sort out every problem in the next 5 minutes. Telling them that problems very often require more time, a degree of sacrifice if you're going to get them right, that's more of a difficulty.
And key here is political education. Really, if a leader has ideas about where he wants to go, he's really got to communicate that to his constituencies.
Yes, I remember years ago, my own party in the United Kingdom produced an election manifesto which was entitled Action, Not Words. And I saw what they were getting at. But it seemed to me to be absurd for politicians to offer themselves to the electorate on that basis, because you need words as politicians to explain why the actions you're going to take are essential. You need words in order to convince people, even when people may think it's in their short-term interest to do something completely different. Maybe it's the whole thing has been made more challenging as well by the more disparate way in which people get their news and get their information. I was looking at some figures for newspaper sales in Britain between the last election campaign and this one. And back in 2010, when we had our last general election, there were about 10.5 million sales a day of newspapers. These days, that figure's down to about 7.4. So where are people getting their information? Even if they're buying and reading newspapers in Britain, the truth is that those newspapers are much more partisan even than they were in the past, or certainly as partisan as they were in the past. People are getting a combination of news and opinion in those newspapers. Now, I think my children who are in their 30s, early 40s, are well informed, but they hardly read a newspaper. So where are they getting their information? How does a leader, how does a politician appeal to them? And it's a big challenge.
And say 30 years ago, television was the great threat, and today it actually may be social media. Actually, where media television story is now replaced by a few lines.
Oh, that's certainly true. I think television still matters a great deal. And what we haven't really tackled as a society is the consequence of so much television news or televised material being shown on different platforms on the internet, and therefore the news to some extent being determined not by the judgment of news journalists or editors, but by algorithms. You change an algorithm and suddenly the news is slanted in a different way, and the way it comes across may actually reflect advertising and commercial priorities rather than what really matters. So there are a lot of issues which we don't really talk about very much, but are really challenging to a democracy. I think all that makes it more difficult for a politician to get a message across to people in the way that Truman or Roosevelt in the United States, or Churchill, Macmillan, Attlee would have done in the United Kingdom?
A political leader's task, if he has ideas, and that's an if, but if he has ideas, is to navigate the chasm between his ideas and reality.
Yes.
Where, and in that area, he has to compromise. And is that a problem now, that the chasm has gotten wider and wider, and it's much easier to get mud on your face, and we don't have leaders that are as courageous as they used to be?
It's certainly an even bigger problem if leaders don't really have, to begin with, a coherent intellectual view of the world. I mean, one of the things which has depressed me in the last, not just a few years, but for some time, is the number of politicians who need a focus group to tell them what they apparently believe in, and then another focus group to say how they should respond to that. I was very impressed during, or before his first election campaign, or maybe it was during the course of it, when President Obama, when the issue of race came up, instead of consulting focus groups on how he should deal with it, sat down himself and wrote an absolutely brilliant speech. I mean, I think it's probably, he obviously does sometimes make rather better speeches than he delivers actions. But and there is a problem there of bringing what you do into line with what you say. But I thought it was a thrilling example of how politicians should behave, to actually deal with a really difficult issue in a way which was very personal and which argued a case coherently. And you don't find that happening very much. Big political speeches tend to be the exception rather than the rule. And the number of politicians who will write their own speech, increasingly small. There are some who still do, or who can speak extempore and do so extremely well. But in European politics, it's difficult to think of many who do that at the moment.
In preparing for the interview, I found this quote. I believe it came from an interview, our last interview, and you said this: there is a serious problem here, and in my judgment, it's the most interesting in political science. As I said earlier, people feel their natural loyalty and attachment to the institutions of nation states, even while knowing that nation states can't protect them in the way they used to. This is the big problem today, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I wrote about the recent British general election campaign, that one of the depressing things was it took place as though the rest of the world didn't exist, as though there was nowhere beyond the white cliffs of Dover and the English Channel. And yet we know that on issue after issue, just taking the British example, on issue after issue, what happens elsewhere is the main determinant of whether or not you can succeed in dealing with domestic problems. Immigration, for example. You can't deal with immigration in one country. You have to take a broader view of the factors which in Europe, for example, are pushing poor Africans and people from calamity in the Middle East onto those wretched boats trying to cross the Mediterranean to find a haven in Europe. Now, those are issues which are picked up dramatically by populists who want to close the doors and the windows to any immigration. But you can't actually deal with those issues unless you cooperate with other countries, unless you pull together development assistance, security policies, foreign policy, as well as immigration policy. Look at the as well at the what's I think a 21st century example of the 30 years war in the 17th century, the present struggle between Sunni and Shia, which is what it amounts to in the Middle East. That has a huge playback into our societies in Europe, in the United Kingdom, where even second, third generation members of immigrant diasporas from Muslim communities find themselves drawn by all sorts of unattractive magnets into those disputes themselves. There was shortly after the Hebdo disaster and killings, there was a cartoon in one of our satirical magazines which showed bombers taking off from a runway and one of the pilots saying to the others, "It seems an awful long way to go to bomb young men from South London." That has been the reality for European countries. So just in those examples, what I'm trying to say is that and I think it's something I argued in a book called What Next, and would probably argued when I last spoke to you, I think we should all be aware of is the extent to which the requirement for more international cooperation, partly because of some aspects of globalization which we can't row back, has come up against the fact that the public support for the institutions to underpin that cooperation has been fraying. And it's true if you look at UN bodies, if you look at regional cooperation institutions, if you look at the European Union. There is this reluctance to accept the authority and legitimacy of those institutions, and there's a tendency on the part of politicians to affect to believe that they can do a lot more than is actually the case.
And the irony here, of course, is, as you describe in your most recent book, the extent to which there's so many global problems, from immigration to crime to the environment, that can't be handled alone by the nation state.
That's right, the arms trade, health epidemics, one issue after another requires international cooperation. And I guess most leaders know that, but they don't explain it very well. Take an issue which about which a lot has been said and a lot has been written, but alas, not awfully much done. Thanks to several very well-known and respected foreign policy specialists, the UN bought in, I think, 2005, into the notion of the responsibility to protect. That is the idea that nation states don't have rights which completely take precedence over the rights of individuals. And if individuals' rights are being trampled on, there's an obligation on other countries to try to prevent that happening. To put the point very crudely, not necessarily by military intervention, though that's not ruled out, but by other ways as well. The responsibility to protect, and it's debated at the UN towards the end of Kofi Annan's Secretary Generalship, and the UN General Assembly votes enthusiastically for it. They'd no sooner voted for it than they got buyer's remorse. And you've seen in the last few years examples where our failure to have a way of responding to failed states has led to catastrophe. Libya is an example where there was a military intervention which overthrew Colonel Gaddafi, and then we walked away, and there's chaos today. Syria was an example where, partly because of Libya and partly because of Iraq and Afghanistan, we didn't intervene. We said that would make a greater mess than existed. Well, when you see the mess that has been created in Syria and around Syria, could it have been any worse if we had intervened? But there is an example, a really difficult question of where you cooperate internationally, and we haven't sorted it out. We haven't sorted it out intellectually in a sort of academic sense, and we certainly haven't sorted it out on the ground. Plenty of politicians have made speeches about it. Tony Blair made a brilliant speech over a decade ago in Chicago about it. The neocons made speeches which sort of implied that America in a unipolar world could do anything it wanted and could make the world, the rest of the world, correspond to it, to their own view of reality. That was plainly off the wall. So a lot's been said and argued, but we haven't really, not least as Western democracies, tried to sort out together how we're going to respond to these issues.
In your books, you talk about a quote from Thucydides. It comes up actually several times through the years in your books. It was something you read and learned and retained from your days as a student at Oxford, in which the Athenians tell the Melans, the strong do what they have to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept. Now, it's interesting as we talk about international governance and we also the EU, that in the case of both the U.S. and the Germans, there's an unwillingness on the one hand to assume responsibility and on the other to change institutions or visions as they are applied to the larger arena. And so, for example, the U.S. has blocked the transformation of international organizations to reflect the new balance of power. And the Germans have been unwilling to change their vision of economic management as it applies to Southern Europe. Talk a little about that, because it seems to be kind of examples of that quote from Thucydides.
Yeah. It's very relevant to the present argument about whether Western countries and other countries, not just Western, should sign up to be members of the proposed Asia Infrastructure Development Bank, which the Chinese have launched, which Britain and other European Union countries have signed up to, much to the dislike of the United States, which thinks that it's a bank which may undermine existing regional and global financial institutions, may not have the highest standards of prudential government, and so on and so on. But the truth is that the Chinese have done that because we didn't reform in time. The management of the IMF and the World Bank. We didn't change those institutions so that they took greater account of the growing economic weight of what we used to call the third world and now call emerging markets, and in particular China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and so on. So there's a sense in which we brought that down on our own heads. It's not too late to look at the World Bank and the IMF in that constructive way. But we're going to, if we don't reorganize the world order or its institutions that we created in the 1940s, other people will try to create parallel institutions. And it's not enough simply to stamp one's foot. The Athenian very arrogant letter to the Melians, which eventually led to the destruction of the Melian society, death, imprisonment, was a very good example of unipolar arrogance. That I don't think it's as much of a problem today, but it was certainly a problem in the early years of this century with the Bush administration. It's a danger if you go from that to saying nothing works, we don't have any duty to lead, we'll just try to get others to take a leadership role and keep our powder dry. The truth is, and it's a real problem for the United States, that unless the United States gives a lead on most issues, they won't get sorted. It sort of goes with the territory, as I said in the lecture here the other day. So the United States has to find a way in which it can take on the responsibility of trying to mobilize coalitions to deal with the threats that nobody else is going to deal with themselves, and has to take quite sophisticated views of the extent to which the US should allow the fact that it's strongest economically, strongest militarily, biggest political reach, the extent to which that should enable it, allow it to shape every answer in a US direction or in the US mold. And it takes a lot of voluntary restraint and magnanimity to avoid doing that. A great thing about the 40s and 50s is you did do that. You didn't simply create institutions which suited the US interest, though in the long term they did suit the US interest, and they worked because people knew that you accepted the rules as well as trying to apply them to other people.
Is the problem here that the old order, shall we call it, where the U.S. was shaped, was with through consultation designing the new world, that old order developed interests which now obstruct a leader from moving to the shape of the new world? I mean, one wonders, for example, in the Obama administration's thinking about this, the Asian Development Bank, who's dictating the policy, somebody with a strategic vision or the Treasury Department?
Well, I hope it's not just the Treasury Department, though it may well be. There is a relationship, clearly, between sensible economics and sensible international politics. And I noticed that's only in the last few days been asserted by a group of largely security-related public officials, people like Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell and General Petraeus and others, who have been arguing for giving the president fast-track authority in relation to trade deals with Asia and with Europe, because there is a relationship, and a strong one, between economic prosperity and economic relationships and security matters. And I think that it will be a tragedy if the United States isn't able to get agreement on the Asia and European trade deals, both because of the impact on the beneficial impact on the global economy of those deals, and because of the extent to which they address serious geopolitical issues in which the United States has such a big interest. I think it's for your friends outside, it's a dilemma that we look at the American Party political structure and see the Democratic Party, which is in favor of international institutions and international agreements, opposing free trade, and Republicans by and large supporting free trade, but opposing the creation of the institutions which are needed to underpin it and make it fair. It's quite difficult to shape a sensible trade and economic policy against that background.
You are a member of the Tory Party, and you chose to be a conservative after you had served in Mayor Lindsay's campaign in America. When you talk about that commitment to the Conservative Party in terms of what you see it representing at that time. And then the question is, does it still have that vision that attracted you?
When I worked in the mayoral campaign for John Lindsay 100 years ago, 50 years ago, the Republican Party in New York was represented by people like Jacob Javits, Nelson Rockefeller, Keating. They were a sort of Republican that no longer exists. Dick Lugar was like that, who was who was a great international public servant, great servant of the United States, and then destroyed by the Tea Party in Indiana after years of service in Indiana. Fortunately, what's happened to the Republican Party moderate center has not also happened to the Conservative Party. But we have two, our right wing, who are driven by dogmatic positions, by an ideology which I don't recognize. In the Conservative Party, and what attracted it, me to it, was that it wasn't dogmatic in the sort of way which was excoriated by Edmund Burke. It didn't have a grand solution in the way that the left often does. It didn't try to fit everything into one simple model. But as the philosopher Oakeshott used to argue, thinking that there is a sort of ironclad model which you can put in place of the left's model of doing things is as bad as what the left have suggested, and that a sensible conservative, and my own country is conservative, I think, with a small c, a sensible conservative tries, to quote myself again, what I said earlier in this interview, tries to find a way in which you can get through life in as amiable and decent a way as possible. That involves your responsibilities to ensure as much fairness in society as possible. It's an attempt to ensure that everybody can aspire to do better for themselves, can grow both educationally and in terms of prosperity. It involves a belief in the smaller battalions, to quote Burke again, in smaller institutions, which can help to keep the state in check. It doesn't denounce the state, but it tries to ensure that the state helps us to lead our own lives and run our own lives more effectively, rather than to take those decisions into its own hands. There are all sorts of reasons why I'm a moderate conservative, and I think that my critics could perfectly well argue that I've never really changed my position. I mean, I've seen other politicians whiz past me in both directions. But whether it's a specific issue like the European Union or an approach to politics, I find myself feeling the same things and saying the same things that I was saying 40 years ago.
We're speaking on a day in which the British election returns have come in. The Conservatives seem to at least have a plurality, enough for a majority of their own. We'll see where that all takes us, or the British. But there is a sense where there are a number of problems that weren't addressed in the campaign. And I think two of the big ones, and we've discussed a little about this, is one is the effects of globalization and an articulation of the way the United Kingdom needs the world and the way in which the world needs its contribution. Was globalization one of the issues and the effects of things like immigration on Britain? Was that one of the things that failed to be addressed and should have been addressed in a better way by both parties?
Yes, certainly. It was addressed by a new sort of upstart populist party called United Kingdom Independence Party, which basically wants to stop globalization, wants to step the world and get off, and has a vision of Britain which is goes back to a society that never was. White, hard-working, God-fearing, listened to with respect in the world, insular, complete unto itself. That's never been what Britain has been like. There's another thing, however, which has worried me, and that is, one of my bosses in the past was a foreign secretary called Douglas Hurd, who used to talk about the importance of Britain punching above its weight, and I think in this campaign, and it may be a consequence of our reduced status in the world, there has been almost an implied acceptance that we should settle for punching below our weight in the world. And things which we do very well, we've been cutting expenditure on, we've been trimming back. I still think that even as a less important economic power, we still have a huge contribution we can make to the world. And I would have wished to have heard more about that in this campaign. I think we should be committing to spend rather more on defence than we do. We've seen a huge cut in the amount of money we put into our Foreign Office. Thank heavens we haven't cut international development assistance, where we have a very good record. But in areas like higher education, public service broadcasting at the World Service, the British Council, our cultural contribution to the world, I don't think that governments or politicians have given enough support to those aspects of Britain which do make an impact, which is well above the economic weight of our national income.
And one of the ways you punch above your weight is by being enough of a player to influence change in the EU with regard to relations with the United States. And once you're perceived, I guess, as cutting across the board and being a lightweight, then that influence will pass.
Yeah, those who were opposed for, I think, bizarre reasons to our membership of the European Union continue to assert that we'd be a much better ally for the United States and if we were outside the European Union, and the United States should recognize that. The United States keeps on telling us, presidents, officials, business, that we really matter as a partner to the United States, very largely because we're at the heart of the European Union. And the United States has always supported that. And it's one of those examples which you've seen in American politics as well, of politicians trying to create their own reality, in which we say that we know more what is in your interest than you do yourselves. And it's a pretty odd way of trying to conduct foreign policy. If we were to leave the European Union, it would be bad for us economically. We would be settling for the proposition that outside the European Union, as a reduced economy, we could cope on our own in a world of not just the US, but giant China and India and so on. And I think it's self-delusion.
And Cameron has set a trap for himself because he's called for a referendum in response to the pressures from the extreme right party.
Yeah, and to pressures within his own party. And one shouldn't forget that the last time the Conservative Party had a majority in Parliament, albeit a small one, but I think bigger than the present majority will be, the right-wing anti-Europeans made life impossible for John Major and his government, and eventually helped to lay the foundations for Tony Blair's victory in 1997. And I hope that the right-wing anti-Europeans in the Conservative Party don't do that again. The election has been won largely because of the respect that the public have in David Cameron's leadership. The election hasn't been won because of the antics of some right-wing anti-Europeans. And I think that it's very important that they cut the Prime Minister enough slack to allow him to run the government in the way which would be best in our national interest.
The other elephant in the closet seems to be this issue of inequality. Now, globalization has furthered equality internationally, but within countries like Great Britain and the United States, it's really had negative effect on the inequality within the country.
Yes, that's true. Also, I think within some countries which have seen a reduction overall in poverty, they've nevertheless, like China, seen an increase in the gap between the poorest who remain and the richest. It is a difficult issue, and it's one which we have to face in the United Kingdom by ensuring that there is a tax regime which is fair to every member of society, that recognizes that the rich have to pay a decent share of their income or their resources in order to help sustain the benefits of those who are poorest. We want to encourage a community in which more people work. We want to give everybody a fair crack of the whip, but you start to develop a real sense of grievance if the haves seem to be getting a lot more with which to have than the have-nots are getting. And I'm afraid that has happened to some extent in the last few years.
As the last Governor General of Hong Kong, you have great experience in terms of dealing with the Chinese, with their actions today as their power increases. What lessons do you think you've learned from that experience that should apply in this different context of dealing with them feeling their oats as a great power?
I'm not in favor of trying to contain China. I think that's a dangerous proposition. I don't take the view that China doing well is bad for us. I think China doing badly would be awful for us. Given the importance of the Chinese economy to economic growth and prosperity elsewhere. But I don't think that we have to accommodate China's every whim or every alleged strategic interest. I think China has been throwing its weight around in the region, not least in relation to maritime issues, the development of oil exploration in the seas around the Chinese coast. I think that China, in many ways, has a big qualitative impact on the world because of the size of its economy, but doesn't have much of a quantitative impact. It doesn't have a better way of running societies than that which is exemplified by a combination of democracy, welfare, and capitalism. China doesn't have something which trumps that. I think we should, in our relations with China, operate on a pretty straightforward contractual basis. When they do things that we like, fine. When they do things we don't like, we should say so. There is, in parts of the business community, in most Western societies, and certainly in some governments, certainly in the Treasury in my own country, the assumption that you can only do business with China if you are servile, if you do whatever they want, if you try to do business on your knees. And it's completely untrue. The Chinese do business on the same basis as everybody else. They buy what they want at the best price they can get it for. And they invest in other countries if they think they can make money there. They don't invest if they don't think they can make money. So if you look at Britain's export performance to China, which is pretty bad, it's not bad because of we're in the political doghouse. It's bad because we don't make enough things that they want to buy.
What about Russia? Is the West failing in regard to dealing with Russia and Putin's emphasis on an old style of diplomacy, not diplomacy, but management of national security?
Look, I think that it's a huge problem for Europe and for America too, but particularly for Europe, where I think it's become, to use a sort of French word, an existential issue. I think it's going to determine the way we deal with Mr. Putin the next few years, a really defining issue for Europe, and whether it is to have any sort of constructive role in international and security relations. What Putin has done in the last few years it with that mendacious, bullying adventurism that we've seen. It's not just to overturn treaty after treaty, international agreement after international agreement, the UN Charter, Helsinki Final Act, 1994 agreement with the Ukraine, etc., etc. It hasn't just done that. It's actually challenged the basis of order and stability in Europe since the war, that you don't change borders by force, that you don't, that you have no right to tell other countries what allies they can have and how they should themselves behave internationally. It's going back to the crudest sort of spheres of influence in a 18th, 19th century way, which brought us at the beginning of the 20th century a good deal of disaster. So I think Mr. Putin is a very dangerous man indeed, and I think it is preposterous to behave as though if we treat him nicely, he'll go away and learn to share our values. I don't think Mr. Putin shares our values for one nanosecond. I think, as I said, he's with the annexation of Crimea, with the invasion of eastern Ukraine, with the attempts to destabilize the whole of the Ukraine, following on Abkhazia, Transnistria, South Ossetia, the pressure put on the Baltic states. I think all that speaks to a pattern of behavior which should be regarded as anathema to what we've managed to achieve in Europe in the last few years. I can't say strongly enough how much, to me, that argues for us increasing rather than cutting our expenditure on defence, not trying to launch a new Cold War. I think in some respects Mr. Putin's already done that, but trying to make it clear that we're not going to be pushed around.
Looking back...
And I'm supposed to be... I'm a moderate.
Looking back in the standard you've set for yourself in politics and viewing the political world, and if we look back, how do you compare recent British leaders, Thatcher, Blair, and Cameron, if you will? I mean, how well would the first two have done in the present time?
Well, of course, some of the problems that Cameron has to deal with are a consequence of the successes and failures of the other two. I think Cameron is a very traditional conservative leader. He is conservative with a small c in a decent and non-ideological way. I think that, like John Major, he thinks he has a responsibility to try to hold the Conservative Party together on Europe. Whether that's possible, we'll find out in the next few years. But I think if he had, he wouldn't say this himself, because it would be full of so much implication for his party leadership, by his party management. I think if he was to be compared with another Conservative leader, the one you'd think of most clearly is Harold Macmillan. He's not as highly strung as Macmillan clearly was in private. He's rather a calm fellow. He doesn't think that politics is the most important thing in life. He and his wife tragically lost a child, a profoundly handicapped child, before he became Prime Minister. And I think if a couple have gone through that sort of experience, to be frank, everything else must be relative. You know, you get up in the morning and one of your colleagues has made an awful speech criticizing you. You know, you put that in context. I remember, which was a very clear, for me, example of the sort of person he is. A couple of summers ago, he invited some old-timers like me to have dinner on a Friday night at Chequers, his country home. And he'd had an awful week with the Conservative Party in Parliament behaving very badly. And if it had been, I've been to similar occasions with Margaret Thatcher and John Major, both of whom, in different ways, I had a lot of time for. John Major's a really good friend. Margaret Thatcher was very kind to me. But if you'd gone after a week like that to have dinner with them, they would have spent the whole evening saying how ghastly these people were, what idiots they were, how much damage they were doing. For Cameron, it was just another week at the office, and he hardly mentioned it. He was casual, relaxed, talked about all sorts of things other than politics. So he's people criticize him for being, the word they use is chillaxed, for being so laid back. I think it's a big strength in a leader not to be completely obsessed with the news in a 24-hour, 7-cycle. And I think he retains his sanity and his sense of balance better than most. He's not perfect. I think sometimes he gives too much ground to the right wing and the Conservative Party, but I know why he's doing it.
And Blair and Thatcher, do you have any brief thoughts about either?
Yeah, they had something in common which they'd both deny. They both knew that you couldn't run the country by moving to the extremes. Thatcher loyalists, people who can see no bad side to Margaret Thatcher, often claim her as being more right-wing than she was in practice. She was pretty cautious. She did shift the middle ground in British politics in her direction, but she did it quite cautiously, and she never, ever made the mistake of thinking that you could win elections by abandoning the centre ground. Tony Blair believed that passionately as well from his side, and what the election result yesterday has shown is the wisdom of his observation that you couldn't win a British election by moving the Labour Party to the left. It just doesn't work. You have to actually capture the centre ground and centrist voters, because we're not a left-wing country. They were both hugely skilled. I think the tragedy of Blair was the Iraq War. I don't think that history will judge him kindly because of that. And we still bear the wounds from it today. And some people literally bear the wounds from it with limbs which they lost or members of their families whom they lost. It was a terrible, egregious calamity. And Tony Blair can't wash his hands of his responsibility for it. But he was an outrageously outrageously gifted political leader with the ability to argue any case more effectively than most people could manage, and in terms which sought to bring together what seemed like a sort of moderate guy trying to do his best. It was an extraordinary routine.
One final question, and that is drawing on your experience now as someone who's returned to Oxford as its chancellor. What advice would you give to students preparing for this future? Because implicit in your analysis is the notion that citizens are going to have to be responsible. If we're lucky enough to get responsible leaders, we're going to need citizens who can act in their careers with both a national and a cosmopolitan view on the one hand.
Well, I'm doing a commencement speech at the end of this week, which I've never done before, because they're not part of our British tradition. And I've been thinking what to say in this speech without sounding sanctimonious. And it is, of course, true that young men and women growing up in America are going to have more responsibilities for what their world and the rest of the world looks like than if they were growing up in some other countries, because America is still the only superpower, the only country that matters everywhere, matters more than anybody else everywhere. So there are particular responsibilities on them. and those are duties which they can't disown. And I think that my main message to students is always that at great universities in America and Europe, they're growing up with vast advantages which a lot of most of the rest of the world doesn't have. And there's an obligation on you in those circumstances, in an old-fashioned way, to try to put back more into the community than you take out of it, or at least some of what you take out of it. There's another thing which I try to say to young people, and that is that we're only here once. I mean, I know there are some people who think we may come back as cos lettuces and ready for chez panisse, but or as butterflies. but for most of us, we think we're only here the one occasion. And my God, you better make the most of it. I think young people really, really should never settle for anything but what they think is the best and what they most want to do. If you want to go to Indonesia and live in a rainforest for a bit to discover more about Indonesian beetles, rather than join a bank or a consultancy for a large amount of dosh, go and do it, because you won't get the chance again. The young people have, which I hope is a great advantage, provided we don't do anything calamitous, a great advantage over us. They're going to live a lot longer. They're going to be on this planet for 20 years longer than us on average. And therefore, they've got even more of an obligation to make the most of it while they're here. And they've got more time to make decisions. I must just finish on this point. When I was first here, I was 21, and here in San Francisco for the first time. And in those days, you were 21, you'd finished university, and you thought you had to make a decision then about how you were going to spend your life. You know, you'd join you'd become a chartered accountant, or you'd become a teacher, and that was you until the funeral parlor. But it's not like that now. People can have all sorts of careers, but at any one moment, you really should be, I think, aiming to do what most interests you, where you think you can make the biggest and most valuable impact, and where you can stretch yourself most. I think, to put it at its simplest, it's a great opportunity to have, and what's the alternative?
On that note, Lord Patton, I want to thank you very much for giving us this time and this great opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.